Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 627. This episode of Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by King of the Nerds, which is coming back on TBS Friday, January 23rd at 9 p.m. with Curtis Armstrong, who was amazing on the podcast, if you hadn't heard that episode, and Robert Carradine. And it's set to kick off the third season. And I have to say, I was skeptical of King of the Nerds before it came out, Kyle Clark.
I'm a more firm believer in democracy of the nerds and not a monarchy.
But it ended up being a fun show, and they're sweet dudes.
I think as long as they're existing, where we can have a parliamentary system along with the symbolic monarchy.
A little too much on the political structure of the.
I feel like that's the nerdiest thing I could do about it.
Oh, Matt,
back to
nerd.
The thing.
You are now king of the nerds. Oh my god! Well, wait, woohoo! But you didn't want a monarchy, but now you're the head of the monarchy. So that makes it okay? Because that would make you kind of a hypocrite.
Do I have to step down like George Washington and decide to just be president? Damn it, democracy's hard.
Yeah, it really is. Well, you know, use your power responsibly. Kyle Clark will not be on King of the Nerds, by the way, when it premieres for season 3. You knew you weren't going to be on. What do you
know?
But I can hope.
They can add me in post.
January, they're not going to add you in post, I promise. January 23, 9 p.m., TBS, season 3, King of the Nerds.
What if I just sent him a bunch of footage of me in front of a green screen and was like, guys, I don't know if you're running a little light on an episode.
What a compelling argument. Let's see. I see no way
that this could go wrong. I agree.
Yeah. But Danica's on this season,
ooh,
by the way. Danica and Penn Jillette.
Ooh.
And Moby. Three podcasts
Moby?
So far, yeah. And who else? Lisa Loeb is going to be on.
Oh.
Mm. Yeah, don't. Come on.
I didn't say. I just moaned a little bit because, I don't know, you know.
We went out for like 4 months.
To be honest, I'm still thinking about how much I like Moby.
I never dated Moby.
You should.
You think? We're friends. Like we could.
Maybe you guys take it to the next level. And then when you guys are friends, you can be like, hey.
What if I show up at Moby's house and sing Stay, I Missed You?
Oh, that'd be amazing. Can we just put that on the website? Can that
Craig
just
Robinson,
be a thing?
In the trailer for Hot Tub Time Machine 2, Craig Robinson is singing Stay, I Missed You in one of the. It's really funny. It's really funny. What are you up to this week?
It's my birthday tomorrow.
That's right! It's, oh my god, Kyle
right?
Clark's birthday. Kyle Clark is rad
it
on Twitter.
It is actually my birthday the day this is out, so they're listening to this on my birthday. They listen to the day long.
Happy birthday, Kyle. You. It's your fucking birthday. Because birthday songs, you know.
I like that. It's a very 90s birthday song.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we'd have to pay royalties if we sang the actual birthday song.
Nah.
It's your fucking birthday, Kyle.
That's a better birthday song. I like the cat.
It's your fucking birthday.
You get kind of a Rob Thomas approach to it there.
Yeah, it's your fucking birthday. Yeah, it's your fucking birthday.
I've kind of morphed into Alanis Morissette at the end.
Well, it's your birthday. You ought to know. Start bringing up 90s people that I can
it's
channel.
Like having like 90s demons inside of you. Just pull your shirt open and just Rob Thomas, Alanis Morissette coming out.
Yeah, it's like that scene in Scrooge where he gets in the elevator and death is there.
Exactly.
And he opens the thing and all those faces. Yeah.
My body is a roadmap of the 90s.
That would be an amazing affliction to have. This podcast is, I'm going to say this was huge for us. This is Bill Gates.
Oh, I've heard of him.
Have you heard of William H. Gates III? And
is that his real full name?
William H. Gates III.
I didn't know about the third. I try to keep track of that shit.
Yeah, William H. Gates III. Which, by the way, if you're a billionaire captain of industry, I feel like traditional captain of industry rules would dictate that you need to go by initials only. Like, he should have been W.H. Gates III.
Oh, that's a good name,
I mean,
too.
Bill was my dad's name. My dad was a bowler. My dad didn't
Bill
invent
is
Microsoft.
Very disarming.
Yeah. And Bill Gates was actually very disarming.
Yeah, super sweet guy.
It was really fun to talk to him. We went up there because the annual Gates Foundation letter is coming out
today.
Actually, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where they basically tell you the Gates Foundation has, you know, set aside – I mean, it's
got a 15-year
like almost $40
plan.
Billion of money that they're...
it's a really inspiring letter. Like I was reading through it. It's amazing. Like, they're such a great foundation.
I mean, you know, one school of thought is, hoard all your money. And another school of thought is like,
fix the world.
Give as much of it back as you can.
It's incredible the things they've accomplished.
So there's a few things about this this episode. Number one, we talked a lot about the Gates Foundation. You know, we drifted a bit into... some of the nerdier stuff that I wanted to ask him about.
You did ask him if he's played Zork, and
well,
I was very proud of you.
You know what I forgot to ask him? GIF.
Oh! Oh!
I know. I'm mad. I forgot. I should have asked him the ultimate question for me. But one fella in particular was exceptionally keen on us focusing on the foundation, as you'll hear, you know, which I completely understand. I mean, like, they're, you know, the work they're doing is incredible, and of course should be.
We're trying to save the world.
We're trying to save the world. Could you please stop talking about obscure computer games from 1981?
But what kind of world do we want to live in without disease or poverty if you can't talk about obscure text adventures?
So, but I will say this, you know, in the moments where we drifted into that with him, I mean, obviously he was passionate. He's obviously passionate about the Gates Foundation, but there was something really special I could see in his, just being in front of him and seeing in his face, talking about Comdex, talking about like the early days of computing and how they built the TRS-80. I mean, like, it really, I could see like, this is a guy, he loves this.
Hearing him rattle off old program code language, just sort of, just like it's nothing.
Oh, so much fun.
So cool.
It was a really great experience. And so when we were wrapping up the interview, the reason that it's that you will see that it's an hour and 50 minutes long is because as Bill was leaving to go do something else, they said, oh, okay, so if you want to go downstairs, you can talk to some other people from the foundation. And at first, I fully admit, I think I was like, oh, you know, I think I'm good. You know, we got the guy. Like, I think, you know, I think we're good. But I thought, you know, I'm kind of curious to see. And they said, well, there's this guy named Jay Wenger, and Jay is heading up. He's an epidemiologist, and he's heading up our efforts to eradicate polio. So I was like, all right, well, that actually sounds kind of interesting. So I sat down and talked to Jay for about 35, 40 minutes. And then Julie Sunderland, she handles the investment pool that the Gates Foundation essentially invests like $1.5 billion, like you would if you were an investment pool. But instead of trying to make money, what they're trying to generate is a better lives for people. So I talked to her for like another 35 minutes. So Bill is 0 to 40 minutes. And so if you feel like, I got it, you know, like that's all I came here for, that's great. But I would also further challenge you to listen to Jay, who had incredible stories.
Jay's in particular blew my mind.
Incredible stories about literally trying to eradicate a disease from the human race. And Julie was a phenomenal talker and super engaging, and so many things that I didn't understand about, like why you can't just go give a country $1 billion and go, okay, you're fixed, you know, like ways that they have to do that by building infrastructure and creating technologies and things that actually like make the social soil fertile for them to flourish. So I would say, you know, give it a shot and listen to the whole thing, because they both, at the end of it, I was like, holy shit, I can't believe I almost didn't do that, because we wouldn't have gotten this. And so, you know, I just want to thank the Gates Foundation for having us up there, and it was an incredible experience. This podcast was also brought to you by Birchbox. You know, you probably every day use like shampoo or shave cream.
I'm familiar with these concepts.
No, you're not. Your hair seems clean, but you don't use shaving cream. Do you shave your cheeks?
I do the cheeks and the neck.
Do you have you tried Birchbox yet?
I have not. Tell me about this product.
Well, Birchbox lets you test drive a personalized batch of grooming and style essentials. Kyle, yeah, that's right. Subscribers receive every month 3 to 4 grooming samples plus a dapper accessory. And I think you could use some more dapper in your life. All tailored, now that you're a big boy and it's birthday.
That's true. I need something to accentuate these sweaters.
I made Katie laugh. It's $20 a month. Your box is going to get a full range of top shelf grooming samples, heritage shaving creams to woodsy colognes, gadgets, bar tools, stylish accessories. Birchbox also has a great loyalty program, Points Equal Money. You earn 1 point for every dollar that you spend in the shop, and every 100 points is equal to $10 to spend in the shop. So
another 10%.
The more you spend, the more you get. Right now, of course, head over to Birchbox.com, use the promo code NERDIST to get 100 Birchbox points with the purchase of your subscription. That's $10 to spend on your new favorite products.
Birchbox, you'll be so dapper, you'll think you're wearing a monocle.
I hope they use that from now on. Happy birthday, Kyle Clark.
Thank you, Chris.
Here's NERDIST Podcast number 627 with William H. Gates III.
Now entering NERDIST.com.
Keep our name tags on. We'll make it easy.
Oh, did I keep mine on?
So you can't be in this building without a name tag. We're going to have to ask you too. I'm sorry. You're going to have to.
I can only not have
him. Are you his? You're literally his name. You're like his human name tag. You let everyone know.
That's how I let everyone know that this is Bill.
Are you making a bootleg of this podcast?
That's right. I am.
Or it's free. You're not going to.
Yeah, we do give it away.
I think we're about to get tased. Are we going to get tased if we ask a question?
Okay, good. All right.
Well, it depends on how this goes, I guess.
Okay, oh. Well, why
does
pressure?
Why does his recorder look better than ours?
It's pretty similar.
I don't know.
It's way cooler.
A bit different. I feel like his design is a little more.
We can compare afterwards audio quality.
He's in another room. It sounds even better somehow.
Yours has one of those cool buttons on the side. Welcome to your offices, Mr. Bill Gates. I'm wondering, you've been doing meetings, you've been doing interviews all day for the Gates Foundation. Is that what's going on today?
Yeah, I started at 8 this morning and did a couple. The annual letter comes out next Wednesday.
Yep.
And so it's a chance to talk about what we saw and, of course, this year focus on what can be done in the next 15 years.
I read the letter. It was 8 pages, great, quick read, but a lot of information about. There were some things in the letter that I actually never occurred to me. I want to try to cover a lot in the little bit of time that we have with you. So it's loose, conversational. If you want to swear, go ahead. There's no restrictions.
Damn.
Still,
there we go.
Hey, wait a minute.
You're getting
not
there.
The D word.
But we're getting there.
It's getting so filthy. But ultimately, what never occurred to me, someone told me a couple years ago, I think people just assume, oh, well, if you have a lot of money, you can just give money to someone and that fixes all their problems. And the answer is no. You actually have to, from what I want to understand, you actually have to give them the infrastructure to figure out how to distribute that money properly. Is that true?
Well, at the end of the day, it's not money that counts. It's having a good job, being well-educated, having your kids be healthy. And so making sure that those systems, the education system, the primary health care system, the food growing system, agricultural productivity area, those things work well. It's pretty complicated because it's a mix of government and the private sector, and really learning why those things haven't worked well in poor countries, it does require a lot of learning because, you know, it's far away, it's very different than what we experience day to day in a country that's quite well off.
Yeah. Well, but is it because it kind of seems like, well, money is treating a symptom. You have to do the preventative work to make sure that people are educated, they have the right systems in place. But then to do that, don't you need money? Like, what's the chicken and the egg scenario?
Well, if you go back 300 years, you know, things were pretty rough. Over 30% of kids died before the age of 5 everywhere, even the country that was the best off. Some countries got ahead in terms of building very productive agricultural systems, so the nutrition, the amount of food and the variety of food you got was very good. Then that's really the bootstrap. Your agricultural productivity is kind of the starting point. Then that allows you, if you do that well, to do more in the way of education, to do more in infrastructure. And then, of course, we got electrification, mechanization. Productivity in the agriculture sector went up so dramatically that most of the labor then could go over to all these other things. And most of Africa is still back in that phase where almost everybody's a farmer. And most of their output is simply for sustenance, just to feed themselves. And so we have a lot of understanding of, okay, we got productivity up. How can we help them do that? And you're right that when you're poor, the bootstrap is difficult. That's partly why foreign aid and philanthropy come into play a role. Those governments, you know, say they look at malaria and say not only is that killing kids, but it's causing even the kids to survive because of the way their brains have been messed up, to not be able to learn, to not to be able to contribute, they might think, okay, we need to get rid of malaria. But the kind of science and money to create a malaria vaccine and get that out there, they just don't have the resources, the scale to do it. And so they do look to the rich countries, including the United States, to step up and say, okay, you've got science, you've got money, you know, this is all part of humanity. I talk about global citizenship in the letter. And that some of that's been happening, and it has helped a number of poor countries move up. In fact, you know, if you go back to 1960, there were only a few rich countries and lots of very poor countries. The big miracle of the last 75 years is that many of those poor countries like China, Mexico, Brazil, Thailand, South Korea went from poor into middle income. South Korea is actually the extreme. They've gone all the way to where now they're part of the rich country club. But we still have a number of poor countries, a lot of them in Africa, not just. And you still have Yemen, Afghanistan, and a few others. But numerically, the most are in sub-Saharan Africa. And, you know, we know what needs to be done. Some of their soils aren't as good. You know, their terrain, they don't have infrastructure. Without roads, a lot of the stuff is more difficult. And when you're a poor country, you tend to have pretty poor governance.
Sure.
That, and you don't have as many well-educated people. The people are spending their time getting enough food. So the idea of voting is more about expressing loyalty to your tribe than it is evaluating somebody's bureaucratic excellence in creating things. And so governance tends not to work very well until you get up to a middle income status.
Now, when you say if you go back 300 years and you go back to 1960, you literally can do that, right? The Space Needle is a time machine that you're using to travel back in time. Am I correct?
Well, I was alive in 1960.
What's that like?
5 years old. I was born a couple miles south of that Space Needle there.
But we have an amazing view right now of the Space Needle and the EMP Museum, which is incredible. And do you ever wander around the EMP Museum?
Yeah, EMP, you probably know that's a Paul Allen creation.
Mm-hmm.
He had a fascination with
fascination or obsession?
Oh, he plays the guitar.
Sure does.
He loved Jimi Hendrix. And Paul would always say to me, are you experienced? he tried to help me get
Paul, we're working.
Yes on that.
We got to work.
And so anyway, he built that. And it's, you know, actually nowadays it's got science fiction.
Yeah.
It's got quite a variety of things as they've been driving up the traffic. So, it's kind of interesting that our visitor center is right there across from the EMP. And then this whole Seattle Center area had a World's Fair back in 1963, which is one of my earliest memories coming and seeing, you know, and at the time they were showing video phones and Selectric typewriters, you know, what was
robots in the home.
Well, we're getting there.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of bummed there's no more World's Fair. I mean, I understand that the internet and the sort of the localization of the global community sort of made it not as sexy to be like, oh, that's what's going on over there. Oh, that's what's going, you know, like now you can just, you know, you can just go on to Gizmodo or something. Like, oh, these items are coming out. Like, do you miss the World's Fair?
Well, there still are World's Fairs that take place. We just had a Consumer Electronics Show.
Well, of course.
I happened to go. Yeah. So there's still place-based stuff to show off things.
CES's hot air balloons were big this year at CES as part of their fair. I loved did you like CES, the grind of CES?
Yeah, I gave the keynote there for over a decade. I would do a kickoff and talk about, you know, how hardware and software were coming together in magic ways. And there was another show that was in the fall there, Comdex, that was kind of the personal computer industry show. That's where back in 1990 I gave a speech called Information at Your Fingertips and talked about your digital wallet and how all the world's information would be there. No, it was fun. I mean, those were events to kind of see what your competitors were doing and meet with your channel, the people who are selling the products. And so it was a big deal in my Microsoft day to figure out how he'd make a splash at those shows.
But now, I mean, it's now, you know, when channels like the E! Network are showing you stuff from CES. But what were the early days of personal computing? What were these conventions like?
Hey Chris, then we're going to get back to the ladder.
Yes, this is how the podcast works.
Okay, it'd be great, but we want to get back to that. We want to focus on the...
Okay.
Yes. This is just the ebb and flow of how the... Yes. Great. Yes, I promise.
Great, thank you.
All right.
Yeah, it was interesting. The first computer shows were these West Coast computer fair, and that's actually where I met Steve Jobs. He was in his booth with some of the early Apple IIs, and I was there with the company MITS, who we did the software for, that had this Altair 8800.
Oh, the Altair.
And the shows were kind of podunk, but there was a certain sense of excitement. You could go around and see things. And then when it got really big with Comdex, we were like, wow, you know, this is so corporate. Now people have models in their booth. And, you know, it got really amazing, and they built other exhibit halls. But at first it was just kind of, you know, the people talking about their stuff. And we actually created a MITS Mobile that went around the country and started user groups. And I spent a lot of my time going out and speaking at user groups. That's a phenomenon that's not as active as it was back then.
Do you feel – I mean, what did you learn during that period that you're now applying to the foundation? Like what are some of the things – what are some of the similarities and what are some of the tools that you feel you picked up?
Well, the idea of taking on complex science and engineering projects and finding very smart people, you know, getting into the basics of, hey, how do you stop malaria? How do you stop HIV? Who's the smartest? Let's, you know, commit resources to them. And even if it takes 5-6 years, and even if we hit some dead ends, let's stick with it. That kind of engineering belief that was core to Microsoft's success, that carries over to this work. The thing that's different is that in the IT space, if you come up with something fantastic, like a Windows 95, then word of mouth, you know, a little bit of razzle-dazzle, it gets out there. In the world we work in now, where you're trying to get vaccines to all the children in the world, you're working through healthcare systems that people don't necessarily show up, they don't have electricity, the healthcare center's not in the right place. The training isn't done the way it should be. And so that delivery mechanism, we spend a lot of time both on that upstream invention,
sure,
which is very, very, very key, you know, better seeds, new vaccines. But we also spend a lot of time on this delivery part, the downstream part, where you create women's groups and you create measurement systems, you get training programs in, and you're dealing with governments that have very, very few resources and not much background. And so how do you help get them to be self-sufficient and have the system work? There are places like Rwanda and Ethiopia where that's gone extremely well. There's places like Nigeria and Pakistan where it still needs to be done.
Right. And so at least when you're writing code for a machine, it's basically a mathematical problem, I would assume. But then when you're dealing with, like, how do you crack social code, you know, like when you're basically trying to figure out how to organize people and how to essentially program a culture, to reprogram a culture to understand something?
Yeah, the social things are not that mysterious. I mean, if you get the women in the village together to talk about, hey, is the healthcare being done properly, and, you know, talk to each other about we all should get our children vaccinated, you know, that creates a pressure that, you know, helps maintain the performance of the system. And if you have a system that really checks vaccine stockouts, have somebody send a photo of that storeroom, you know, every week and just look and say, hey, there's nothing there, you know, then if the right rewards are in place, that measurement system can drive you to do things pretty well. So I don't think it's because it's super complicated. You have to do it with very finite resources and people with very modest training, but we're getting there. It's kind of like going out and creating user groups. You got to do it everywhere.
Yeah. Does it, when you started the foundation, did it feel like, oh, this? Did you get that charge again of starting a brand new thing, trying to revolutionize something, trying to bring, you know, a technology where there was not technology?
Absolutely. All of our programs, you know, to take one like sanitation of, okay, why don't slums in poor countries have good sanitation, and what kind of problem is that, and could we create something that would almost take the sanitation and make it valuable, and so it's worth cleaning it up and not having the diseases and the smell that the way it works today is so awful. When you first sit with the engineers and say, okay, what's the energy content? What's hard about this? That is like kicking off a software product. Software development cycles tend to be shorter than vaccines or sludge management systems, or even new seeds. A lot of the foundation stuff is a 6 to 8 year product cycle because of the trials that you have to do, safety trials for medicines or field-based trials for crops. And in software, you know, it used to be 2 or 3 years. Now, for a lot of things, it's more like 6 months or a year. So you do get spoiled in IT that the ability to get very quick feedback and change products very rapidly. Most other industries, even in the rich world, don't have that type of quick cycle time.
I was surprised. It never occurred to me in reading the letter, and it's one of the goals was to bring digital banking to people, and it never occurred to me. Oh, well, yeah, of course. Well, they need to have a way to store their money and be able to distribute their money across long distances, and you know, especially if they're used to like a barter system economy. So how do you go in and teach people like this is a bank and you can trust it, and you know, you don't have to put whatever money you have under a mattress. You can put it here, and even though you can't see it, it's fine.
Well, they have money lenders in the village. You know, they just charge extremely high interest rates. And, you know, so if you have to fund a funeral or medicine, then, you know, that's where you turn. So they have the services, but they're very inefficient. They're putting their savings into, say, buying a cow or something that, you know, can get sick, or if you want to sell part of it, that can be very tricky. And it's really just because the way the rich world designed banking, it's got high overhead. It can't deal with a $1 or 50 cent transaction without taking, you know, 20% of the money to fund the personnel and overhead costs. And so what the digital revolution gives us is a chance to build a banking system where for even very small amounts of money, the transaction fees are under 2%, which people view as reasonable. And so Kenya, which is the place this has happened the most, your cell phone is a debit card, and the fees are very low, particularly if you're not converting back into currency, you're just taking money that's sent to you, and then you go into the shop and pay digitally there. And now people are creating innovative products for farmers and school fees. And so, you know, another thing we take for granted has been a huge problem for the poorest that it's not available to them.
Yeah. Now I want to ask a couple history questions, but I promise you it's going to get us back. I'm trying to create as many shareable moments as possible. What do you do on a Teletype Model 33? What can you do on that machine?
Well, you can't do lowercase. so it's like having caps lock on all the time. What you do, you know, the computers were so expensive back then that you would turn on that teletype in what was called local mode, where you would type and a paper tape would encode the characters. It was an 8-channel paper tape, and so it would ASCII encode what you type. So you type up your program in BASIC. Then you would take that tape and put it in the tape reader, call up the computer because you were being charged for every second you were online, and you could play that tape, which would go at 10 characters per second, which is faster than you can type. So that saves time. And then you would ask it to run, and you would pay for the CPU time. Now, one of the teachers at this school accidentally had an infinite loop in his program, and so he went and spent $300 before he realized how to stop it. And so no teacher ever wanted to go in there ever again. And so myself, Paul Allen, and a few other kids, you know, kind of took over this teletype room, and we ended up teaching the programming classes. And, you know, we got down the learning curve, figured out what to do enough that when a company in town here got a computer, they kind of brought us in to just mess around. And so we kept getting experiences, even at a very young age, that gave us a lot of exposure to very state-of-the-art software and programming.
Well, I just think it's interesting, and I think it also does apply to the work you're doing at the foundation, that you're coming into this technology, which there's not really much of a precedent for, and going, oh, well, we have – there's the potential for this thing here, but not only do we have to figure out what types of things we can make, we have to figure out what it is. Like, we have to try to understand what the possibilities are. There's almost a – there's almost like a – there's philosophy there more than just math and engineering.
Well, you have to see what's possible, you know, that you can eradicate diseases, that you can raise productivity. There's some – you know, precedents for these things. There was the Green Revolution that Norman Borlaug led, where they got much better seed varieties in the 1960s and 70s. And that took where people had expected a lot of starvation. Actually, countries like India, instead of having starvation, were actually able to raise the number of calories per person during exactly the period where they thought that wouldn't happen, because that factor of two with the better seeds made – such a magical sure. difference. And it was, you know, that's like a piece of software that he got out to those farmers.
But when you're looking at technology in 1968, are you seeing like this is there's so much here in this machine with no lowercase, there's so much here? Like, you're essentially having to create the idea of the technology in addition to advancing the technology.
Well, the key insight that Gordon Moore said is that we'd have exponential improvement in these things. And, you know, at age 13, I, you know, knew enough math to say that, hey, if you're going to be doubling, then what you're saying is computing power is going to be effectively free. And if you look at that world where only a few big organizations have computers and, you know, they're used for government scientific programs or printing bills and things, you say, okay, how would it be used if it was free? And that's where the dream of personal computing, a small group of people, including myself and Paul Allen, Steve Wozniak, Steve Jobs, you know, Jim Warren, a bunch of people had a very different conception that this was going to be a tool for personal creativity, personal communication, and, you know, eventually once they all got hooked together, this information at your fingertips phenomena would emerge out of that. So we had even though it's kind of a quantitative thing to say something's going to get a million times better, it's qualitatively different. And even people like Ken Olson, who was the CEO of DEC, you know, said, why would anybody want a personal computer? Because he was thinking about how mini computers, where he was, he and his team were the revolutionary who said, no, it's not just mainframes, it's not just $1 million computers, it's $10,000 computers. And we came along and said, no, it's $200 computers. And it did require looking at things in a very different way. The software association, there weren't many software companies, there were about 20 or 30 who did mainframes, mini computer software. Their big award was when you sold 10,000 copies. And they called me up after I'd done the Altair and the Commodore PET and the Apple II and the Radio Shack TRS-80 and a whole bunch of machines.
That was my first computer.
And they said, well, how many copies have you sold? And I said, 4 million. And they said, that's not possible. There are not 4 million computers in the world. And I said, yeah, actually there are. 90% of all the computers in the world run Microsoft Basic. There's this thing that's happened without the traditional computing world noticing. And that's why it was so kind of wild when IBM actually came to us and said, okay, we want to get into this new world. You help design this thing. You do all the software for it and do it in 2 years, because it usually took them 5 years to get a product done.
TRS-80 was my first computer, and my favorite game. Did you ever play the Zork series?
Sure.
You like the Zorks? What were some of your other favorite?
Yeah, TRS-80, you know, we did the character set where you could do borders and things. Tier City was interesting because I had to cram everything into that really small ROM, and they were very impatient about getting the thing done. They'd actually had a really limited integer BASIC before, but then we decided to make it a lot richer. Tier City was a fun project to work on, and we'd let you do address the screen. It used to be you could only do serial output, but then we let you put things in arbitrary places on the screen. Anyway.
That's so fun, though.
It's pre-GUI. People don't understand that all we could do is characters.
GUI, graphical user interface.
At the time, we couldn't do arbitrary bitmaps on the screen. The graphics revolution of TRS-80 was very, you know, kind of big blocks. And then they did a product called Color Computer that got more resolution.
That was the second iteration. Yeah, I had that one too.
Color Computer was really good.
Well, you could hook it up to your TV. Like you could hook the terminal up to your TV, and the TRS-80 that I had was basically just an all-inclusive. It just looked like an old-timey computer.
Yeah, it had that black and white screen built in. But Color Computer was more like an Apple II. It was more advanced than an Apple II, where it used the TV display and it was able to generate colors. That was 6800 based, whereas the TRS-80 was Z80 based. So there were about five different chips that I did BASIC for. 6502, 6800, Z80 were the main ones. And then, you know, the big milestone, of course, is when we moved to what was called 16-bit computing, because that's the bus size. But really, it was 20. We went from 16-bit addressing to 20-bit addressing, you know, which that factor of 16 made a difference. And then, of course, we went to 32-bit addressing, which is what carried us for most of the year. Now we're up at 64-bit addressing.
Oh, I read a quote from you from 1981 that said 640K ought to be enough for anybody.
Yeah, that is not a correct.
That's
quote.
Not a correct quote. Okay, please. Now it is time to set the record straight.
Yeah. So we went from the 8-bit computers, all these early ones. They were 2 to the 16, 64K addressability. And so once you hit 64K, that was it. Now, people did plug-in cards with what it was called bank switching, where even though you only have 64K address, you could change the mode and say, okay, now I'm switching these other memory chips in. Then when I went from – when we commenced IBM to use the – it was 8088, which is a variant to the 8086. That gave us that 20-bit addressing. So that's a megabyte. And we took some of that and used it for ROM and I.O. That's how you get from a megabyte down to 640K. And that was, you know, a factor of 10 gives you some room. And so software like Mitch Kapoor did 123, which was kind of a breakthrough spreadsheet because he had the extra addressability. But it still wasn't going to be enough. We had done a lot of VAX work, which was a full 32-bit address space. PDP-10 was a strangely 36-bit address space. So I never thought 640K would be enough. It was a nice – tided us over, and it gave us enough to do graphics. And so the IBM PC had graphics, 640 by 200 on the normal video card. But then it's the next iteration, which is the Mac, where the graphics gets really fast and really good, or 386-based computers.
What do you – and again, this is going to apply to solving global problems, but – so, you know, in the computing world, you're looking around and you're going, okay, are you looking at what other people are doing and going, how do we make our mark or find our place? You're basically – there's a healthy competition going on in the world at that point, in the world of technology. Are you essentially – is there a competition with the foundation for, you know, mortality and humanity? Like you're basically almost fighting the elements in a weird kind of way.
Yeah, it's not classic competition. In that, you know, there's 10 groups working separately on malaria, and, you know, one will win and nine will lose. And everybody works on malaria, shares all their ideas, and it's through the combination of better bed nets, better drugs, better delivery, better diagnostics, better modeling. We're going to need all those things to defeat the disease. So when, you know, there's a lot of gatherings about infectious diseases here because we have a lot of expertise. And in most of these areas, we're the biggest funder. and everybody's just working together on the same problem. And, you know, that's kind of good because things are more open and helpful, and very different than in the computer industry where it's, you know, classic kind of market-based competition, which works super well for software or, you know, how many Thai restaurants should you have or various things. But we have – there's so few resources in the world compared to how tough these problems are that the communities really pull together.
Yeah.
So kind of the opposite of computer world where no one wants to share anything with anyone.
Well, no, that's not true. I mean, there's all sorts of – you know, we decided that having the platform be available and nobody needed permission to write software or to distribute software. It's funny, we've gone backwards now because to sort of maintain quality, now you're forced to buy through these stores. And so in a way, it's less flexible now to run arbitrary bits on a device than it was in the heyday of personal computing. Now, you know, there's certain pro-user reasons why that control isn't just purely bad. But it's a tiny bit less flexible.
Hmm. Is convenience the enemy, do you think, in our culture? It's like obviously the opening statement of the letter is, you know, when Bill and Paul Allen saw a world that basically where the computers were everywhere and were part of our entertainment and part of our work. But do you think convenience is part of our cultural enemy and not – because back then it's like, oh, if you wanted computing, you kind of had to have some type of understanding about how it works. And now no one – you don't really understand anymore. It's like, oh, just turn it on and make it work and have it send me a car, you know. Are we too spoiled with convenience?
No, it's great that we can take things and make them simple so you can focus on other things. You know, if somebody's writing a book, I'm glad they don't have to understand how we do footnotes and fonts and scaling and ligatures. You know, we did a lot of work so that they can, you know, focus on how they do their creative process. No, it's amazing what a tool the personal computer and now tablets, phones, you know, all the incarnations of digital devices are letting us communicate in better ways, be more creative. You know, it's revolutionizing the media business, even scientific collaboration, which the foundation's involved in. The fact that we can take all our studies and make them free on the internet.
Sure.
You know, the storage cost is a rounding error. The ability of anybody to search in and see patterns. You know, basically every trial we do, we create a digital form of it. And then even people working in other areas can take that data and learn from it. So the fact that we hide old complexities, that's the nature of progress.
What's your favorite font?
You know, we did this – there was this very cool idea to take the fact that the red, blue, and green dots aren't at the same place and actually use that to create what are called true type fonts.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you get more resolution by actually playing with the colors. And it turns out some people see the fringing effects slightly more than other people. So there's even a parameter that you can tune where you give up a little resolution and you get a little less of that funny color thing. Anyway, that was one of our – when we were doing true type fonts, that was to me the very coolest thing was we figured out how to get more resolution out of an LCD screen.
Do you miss that stuff?
Well, I'm working on stuff like that. That's very similar. You know, we had a session with Nathan Myhrvold and Max Levchin last week where we talked about how you use digital currency systems to reduce corruption because you can say when you transfer this money, oh, for that you need to take a picture of the car that you put the gasoline into. You know, if you're going to collect your vaccination fee, you have to take a picture of you know, yourself doing those vaccinations. So we get to do invention. You know, now it's focused on the needs of the poorest. But when you're talking about this sewage processing machine and the complex ways that it deals with sometimes the input's very dry, sometimes very wet, you know, can it handle that? How reliable is this thing going to be? Or you're talking about new things with vaccine technology. It's the same type of kind of I get to learn a lot, meet with great scientists, you know, take big risks about pursuing different approaches for these diseases. It feels, you know, as fun as the innovation from the early computing days, which I love.
Well, I know you guys are working on more effective condoms for third world countries as well. And what an amazing problem solving to say, oh, well, it's not just that we have to have a more effective form of contraception, but or to protect against spreadable diseases, but also to actually like make it as natural as possible so people are more motivated. Like, it's really getting to the underlying part of the problem of like motivating people to want to use them.
Yeah, in a sense, you know, condoms should reduce HIV transmission, and yet, you know, a lot of men don't choose to use them. So this idea of using, you know, carbon nanotubes to make a structure that is not permeable and yet, you know, isn't like a thick layer of rubber, you know, we've given a lot of people, not much money for the first stage, it was just $100,000, but a lot of people applied saying they had ideas about how to do that. And you know, now we're getting results and deciding who we fund for the next stage. That's typically about $3 to $5 million.
What were the now that nerd culture has basically become very widely accepted, which it was not when I was growing up, and I don't know what it was like. What were the proto nerds like, and what was their place in the social stratum?
Well, in an extreme sense, you're only a nerd if you're, you know, not social and people aren't talking to you and you're not talking to them and you're just kind of going to your computer and just sitting there all day. And you know, now the term is used in such a variety of ways. You know, anybody who understands software or talks about, you know, technological thing, you know, back then it was sort of the kind of a shunning of the athletes are cool,
right?
You know, the cheerleaders are cool. You know, if the computer guy asks the cheerleader out, she knows to say no.
Yes later.
Yeah. That's true. She or at least she regretted saying no.
Yeah. Which is more important.
You know, it's great that, you know, girls learning code or, you know, being facile with computers is kind of a mainstream accepted thing. And so, you know, now these terms geek and nerd, you know, it's not totally clear, even hacker, you know, what does that mean? It used to mean you crashed these big time sharing computer systems and got in trouble for doing it.
Now it's just like, oh, I got into WordPress, you know, yeah. Like, I don't know if that really counts as the same thing. But it is, the lines are a little bit blurred, and now there's a pop culture element in addition to just a technological element. But as we're gliding this bird in for a landing, what types of responsibilities do you think that, you know, because obviously not everyone can be a major philanthropist. Like, what are some like micro philanthropies that we can engage in? What can everyone do?
Well, in the tech world, almost every company can think about access. You know, is the service they offer, the hardware they offer, you know, can it get out to kids in the inner city, to these developing countries? And often when you have software with very low marginal cost, the idea of having tiered pricing, where if you can do the distinction right, and we do it with vaccines and drugs, the idea that you'd make it be, you know, say free in education or free in African countries. There are ways you can make the stuff available. Or, you know, if you have technical skills, say during the Ebola crisis, something like how do we look at the maps and do the case reporting system. More broadly, everyone can be what we call a global citizen and have some awareness of this huge difference between the poorest 2 billion and the life we have, and take some aspect and learn about it, you know, a disease, some environmental thing, a particular country. They can try and get out. I encourage people to visit, you know, go for a nice safari, but then have a couple days where you see what the conditions are. And you'll be motivated because you'll see there's been huge progress and that, you know, it's pretty hands-on stuff. You'll meet people that you'll want to help. People's voices politically are very important because the big money actually, it's not philanthropy. The big money is these government aid budgets that fund Global Fund for HIV or Gavi for vaccines. And we're always on the verge with budget cuts that this far away stuff, you know, hey, does that really work? Will somebody complain if we cut it? We need a movement that says, no, we're all part of humanity. We care about those things. We don't want, even when budgets are tough, we don't want those things to be cut. So we're trying to draw people in because, you know, part of the beauty of the increased innovation and wealth that the world has is we ought to be able to embrace humanity as a whole, not just say, okay, do I have enough to eat? Does my family, you know, does my country, but rather at a global level, things like HIV or malaria, let's get rid of those. And let's avoid the negatives. Let's, you know, not let epidemics sweep the world. Let's not let climate change take this farmer productivity, which is always on the edge for these subsistence farmers, you know, get them better seeds and, you know, minimize the amount of heating, global warming that takes place so that whatever innovations we have can offset that negative.
And what's ultimately your – how do you view success? Like across any – for yourself, for the foundation, like do you have a couple – like a principle or two that defines like this is how I know I'm successful or this is how I know this project is successful?
Well, we have some very particular goals. You know, even though malaria can't be eradicated in the next 15 years, I'd be super disappointed if in my lifetime we can't bring an end to that. Likewise, HIV, TB. I say in the letter that in the next 15 years we'll get four diseases. Polio is the best known of those. And that's pretty incredible because heretofore there's been only smallpox, so one in the entire history of humanity. So getting four now and then being on the path to get other big ones after that, you know, that's pretty exciting. The credo of the foundation is all lives have equal value. And so the dream would be to say that, you know, somebody born in Africa has as much chance of getting nutrition, education, surviving to adulthood as somebody born anywhere on the planet. And that gap is being greatly reduced. You know, in my lifetime, you know, maybe we won't get it to absolutely zero, but we can shrink it. It'll be, say, 90% less than when we started this philanthropic work. So that feels pretty good. And then the idea of spreading, sharing how much we enjoy philanthropy and getting involved in these causes, you know, hopefully there's a broader sense, and that's more typical both in the U.S. and around the world, where there are people who are having success, whether it's in the tech industry or other areas, who can also give back.
We should go if you guys want to. I know you want to do a selfie and everything, so we got to do that.
Oh, sure, of course.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, we're done, I guess. Did you have any – are you good?
You're no, good. I loved you on that episode of Frasier where you came out.
Matt's favorite show is Frasier.
Thanks.
But, yeah, thank you so much. It was really great getting even 40 minutes with you. And
yeah,
I hope,
thanks for coming over.
And I hope that – is there anything we should see while we're here? Like, what's your favorite thing in Seattle that we should see before we leave?
Well, you mentioned EMP. That's pretty good. You know, Pioneer Square is kind of our historic center. This whole area is getting a lot of biotech – stuff. Paul Allen's been involved in developing. It's pretty cool. He's got his Brain Institute down here, but it's not that visual, actually.
Do you Pioneer Square? Emerald City Guitars is over there.
Do you miss grunge? Do you miss grunge, Bill?
Oh, I was never that big.
Okay.
didn't fit my nerd image.
I hope you enjoyed the Bill Gates chat. And now moving ahead, as I promised in the intro, here's Jay Wenger, who is an epidemiologist and leading the charge to eradicate polio, Kyle.
Good.
No, he's eradicating polio, Kyle. It's a specific strain of polio.
Oh, God. It has my name on it.
Well, you're not a person. You're a strain of polio.
Like I'm in Osmosis Jones.
Yeah, you are. Oh, my God. Why would you reference that?
That beloved Bill Murray film.
All right. Let's cut out of this before it gets stranger and more esoteric. Here's Jay Wenger, epidemiologist for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Julie Sunderland, who handles the investment fund.
Jay, please sit.
Okay, we'll do.
Get comfortable in this strange living room in the middle of your office building. I like that this... I haven't really tooled around the office a whole lot yet, but I see a lot of, like... we've seen a bunch of focus rooms.
Yes, to maintain our focus. Yes, hard to focus on which one to go to.
You don't know. Like, you need a focus room to figure out which focus room. You need a pre-focus room.
It's distracting, is what it is.
Is there a distraction room?
No,
no, not one distraction room.
Just on the internet. That's your distraction room.
Well, you know, there's some buildings that you go in and you really get the sense like, oh, they just needed space, so they just put a desk there. But here, you really get the sense like someone really thought there needed to be five focus rooms on this wall, and then a dry erase board on this one, and this had to face this way. You can feel
somebody did that.
You can feel the planning. But you would hope. I mean, like, you would hope with what you guys are doing and what you're up against and what you're trying to solve. You would hope that the building that is your home would have some planning, so that you then could go do some planning. So tell us briefly, you know, what your role is here, and then we'll kind of branch off from there. I know you worked in epidemiology, so is that your primary focus here at the Foundation?
Yeah, I was an epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control and also WHO for about 25 years before I came here. But here I'm director of the polio program, and a lot of people work on polio in the Foundation. I have a small group, which is primarily focused on making sure that we use the current tools that we have in country to get rid of disease.
Yeah.
There are other groups in the Foundation that work on different things. So we have communication folks who do this. We have people who work on upstream research, trying to develop better vaccines to help us finish the job even faster and finish it off at the end. But I'm primarily in charge of the group that does the directs the in-country work and the application of interaction with the global program to finish off polio.
So how do you? Let me just make sure that we're recording level is good, because we're in a different room.
Okay, that's good.
And then can someone close the door?
Yes.
Thanks. When you're up against a disease, any disease, it's polio now because that's the one that's relevant, or in general. Do you see it as an enemy, or do you see it as something like, no, we need to understand this so we can just control it better? Like, what's your philosophy up against a disease?
Well, the polio story is a little. Every infection is different, but the polio virus has a interesting history in that it started to cause outbreaks of disease. And polio is a bad disease. It's a virus. It only infects humans, so it can't reproduce anywhere else. So to continue to have polio in the world, you have to have the virus continuing to reinfect new people.
Right.
It'll go into a person, you swallow it, it reproduces in your gut. A person's immune system will get rid of it in 4 to 6 weeks. And during that time, the virus basically has to get excreted, and then somebody else, some other little kid usually, has to swallow water or eat something that has poliovirus on it, and then they get infected, and that cycle just keeps on going and going and going. Now, just a very small percentage of people who get the virus in them actually get paralyzed. It's like less than 1%, but maybe 1 out of 200 kids who actually get infected will get paralyzed. But when the paralysis happens, it can be very bad. It can do everything from paralyze your lung muscles, in which case you die, unless you have supportive care. And in there are these great pictures from the 1950s in the United States with entire gymnasiums filled with iron lungs, basically respirators, where they would put kids who couldn't breathe anymore in them and breathe for them until sometimes they get a little bit better and strong enough to breathe, and sometimes they just remain in the iron lungs essentially forever until they died.
Yeah.
That's sort of the worst case analysis. But the other kind of paralysis, which is more common, is when the virus would strike nerves that do the leg or do the arm. And in that case, you get permanent paralysis of that limb.
Was it FDR?
That's FDR.
Right.
FDR is a classic example
right.
of that. He actually got it when he was an older guy, like in his, I think, late 30s or something. But he ended up with two paralyzed legs and could never walk after that, and became a big proponent of the March of Dimes that actually started to raise money to do something about it. But after all that happened, it was becoming a huge deal in the United States, so that in the 50s, if you, in the summertime and the fall, parents were scared to let their kids go swimming and scared to go to movies with their kids, because anytime you, the theory was anytime you got a bunch of people together or had infected water, you could get disease. And it reached really almost a panic level. A couple of vaccines were developed during that time which could protect kids from disease, and we found out that you could even do one step better. If you use the vaccines right, you could immunize enough kids so that that virus would not find another kid to infect.
Oh, interesting.
And so then you could actually have an entire population where the virus was not anymore. Essentially, the virus died out like the dinosaurs in
sure.
that area. So that happened in the United States first, and then a couple of countries in the developing world started to use the vaccines the right way. And in South America, they got rid of all of the disease that they had there, too. So we had a whole piece of the world that was polio-free. And based on that experience, the World Health Assembly declared that we should eradicate polio from the world. And every country in the world signed on in 1988 to do enough vaccination to get rid of that virus in their country. And that's the Global Polio Program. Started with WHO and UNICEF and Rotary and CDC getting together and promoting this thing. And it went along pretty well using these key vaccines to get the job done. So about in the 2000s, we got stuck in a couple of countries. And these were places where populations of kids were either very poor and very crowded with no sanitation, so the virus really spun around and could really easily infect people, or places where people didn't really want to go,
sure.
Like places where they were having civil wars.
Sure.
And so we got stuck in India, Nigeria, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And those are the places where the virus is still there. The virus was spinning around in those places, had been eliminated from everywhere else in the world. But occasionally, because people have the virus in their gut, and if you get a traveler that can go anywhere now with planes, you would occasionally get reinfection with the virus in other countries. And so those countries presented a threat to the world. And until we finished in those countries, we wouldn't make it. And for a couple years, we were stuck. It was very hard to get it done there. But through a number of innovations and hard work with the countries and the partners, India had its last case in 2011. And right now, we've gone 6 months in the entire continent of Africa where there's been not a single polio case reported. So that's been a huge breakthrough. And we're looking now to focus on that last chunk in the Afghanistan-Pakistan bloc. If we can get rid of it there, the world is polio-free.
Now, how do you, you know, does part of epidemiology deal with the politics or even the social politics of, like, just hearing you say, well, people panicked and they did that, like, when people start panicking or they don't really understand how something is spread and they start making bad decisions because they just don't have enough information. Mm-hmm. Do you partially deal with that, too?
Yeah, it's a huge... the last stages of polio eradication have really been an exercise in not just the science and the epidemiology of what's going on with the virus, but how to deal with countries and especially populations that are moving, and they're usually moving because there's a problem,
sure.
refugee kind of populations, or countries where the civil situation is a big mess, and there are either civil wars or there are so much terrorist activity that people are afraid to go in and vaccinate kids. So those are the last frontiers. The last holdouts of the polio virus are really in places where nobody really wants to go, and it's very difficult to deliver vaccines that kids everywhere really should have.
So that makes it basically just these are things that get in the way of you just when you're like, hey, we're just trying to fix problems in the world. Can we just get rid of the roadblocks?
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, there are a lot of... it gets very tricky because in contrast, I mentioned in the 50s there was polio everywhere in the United States and people were already worked up about it. Now the program has been so successful that there's essentially hardly any polio in the world anymore. We used to have hundreds of thousands of paralysis cases a year and people were scared of it. Now, even in these countries where we still have the polio virus, even in Afghanistan and Pakistan, there are only a couple of hundred cases, so it's hard to get you know, the population concern about it is a little bit reduced, especially with all the other problems that they have in these places.
Yeah, but you know, it's so crazy because you're not just trying to attack a virus. You're trying to change people's behavior patterns.
Sure. Yeah, that's right. Well, we are to an extent. That's right. It's tricky to get. I think this gets really broader. What we're trying to do is deliver something to every kid, no matter how poor they are or how distant they are from a real city, and even if no one cares about these particular people, we're trying to get this health intervention there to every kid. So it's really a sort of a huge equity issue that we're working on, and what we're doing now is trying to ensure that when we go to these places, we not only give polio vaccine, but we do other stuff too, other health interventions, vitamins, nutrition, other vaccines. And so that is that in some ways we are trying to change the way people think about what's available and what kids everywhere should have.
So just because I don't, obviously not really ever having talked with an epidemiologist before, what's day one? Is it like CSI where you're going to go, okay, here's the enemy? And like what do you, when you first come in and you know that, you know, you're up against polio.
Yeah.
And then are you worried that if you do a great job, you no longer have a job?
Well, no, because there's always disease
there's
in the world.
There's always other diseases.
Yeah, it's like, I'm sure it would be great to, like, to-do list, polio, check. Like, yeah. what a great thing to check out for the day. But so I want to try to understand, you know, how you come in, what information you gather, how you start trying to understand it, and then how you start trying to figure out how to fight it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's a good question. I think, and some of that stuff is the same for any infectious disease that you have. So if we see a case of polio, looking at outbreaks is a classic thing that epidemiologists do. And so we had a case, disease happened in Syria, actually, just last year. Syria hadn't had a case of polio for a decade. They used to have a pretty good immunization system where 95% of kids got all the vaccines they ever needed. But, of course, Syria in the last 2 or 3 years has been had a lot of problems, and the immunization system fell apart. So kids born in the last 2 years hadn't been vaccinated at all. We got a case of a kid with paralysis came into a hospital there. They cultured the stool. And the sample turned out it was poliovirus. And so we say, oh, yeah, yeah, what happened there? Why are we getting poliovirus here? And so the epidemiologist is basically looking and saying, why is this disease happening here? What is it about this population that's different from the other ones? And what we found in Syria was the big deal was that no kid less than 2 had been vaccinated pretty much for anything in the last 2 years because the immunization system totally fell apart due to the civil disturbance. The other question it always is, well, yeah, but where did disease come from? How is this? We hadn't had a case in Syria for 10 years. Is this something that was it actually always there and we just didn't find it? Or what happened? And so what we do with each of these viruses, each poliovirus that gets isolated from anywhere in the world goes to the lab, and there's an international network of these things, and they sequence the virus, and they look and see, okay, what are the genetics of this thing? And then they track it. They look back at the bank of gene sequences from all the polioviruses that have ever been isolated in the world, which is somewhere. Mm-hmm. And you can track and see who is that poliovirus's mother and father. And we found that poliovirus in Syria actually came from Pakistan, which made a lot of sense because Pakistan, we knew, was having disease, and that was one place it was churning around, and apparently some traveler at some point had transmitted in there. And that was helpful for us because it showed that, no, this wasn't some really bad situation where poliovirus had been there and had never been stopped, but this was a new importation into a place that had just recently developed a bunch of kids who were really susceptible. So, I mean, the epidemiologist's work in this thing is basically to say, okay, when a virus happens, when a case of disease happens, why is it happening, how did it get there, and why did these people get it as opposed to other people. Once you know that, you can go in there and fix it.
But how do you get that information? Where are you getting that information
from? Well, we get it from surveillance data, and surveillance is important. Every country in the world, as I said, signed on back in 1988 to get rid of polio. Part of that deal is that every country in the world has some system where they're actually looking in their population for polio cases. The way that works in most countries in the world, including Syria, is that healthcare people, even you know, quack doctors, and anybody who takes care of a kid is a part of the system, and they get notified that if they see a kid with paralysis, the one thing they need to do is get a stool sample, actually get two stool samples over a two-week period, and make sure that stool sample gets sent up the line to the labs. And so they do that, even in places like that are sort of basket cases in terms of organization, like Somalia or South Sudan. They have systems where if there's a paralyzed kid, a couple of stool samples get drawn up, and they send it up the line to the lab. They'll send it to the capital, and the capital will send it to some other lab who can actually do something with it. They'll culture it for poliovirus. And from that, that's the system that is in gear all over the place.
So they have to be looking out for it.
Have to be looking out for it. Well, the other way, if they weren't looking out for it at all, you would eventually get overwhelmed. You would eventually get developed. So many, you would get all these people with paralysis coming in, and somebody would think, must be something going on here.
Give me an epidemiologist.
So, but the system we have is better than that. You know, the system we have is something that works routinely, and we have to work at it to keep it going because, again, in a lot of these places that you haven't seen a polio case in 10 years, your interest in getting those two stool samples sort of shrivels a little bit. But it's a constant cultivation of the system to make it work.
Are you a hypochondriac? I mean, I would imagine that this is a field where most people would be like, yeah, I'm not a hypochondriac, and then working in epidemiology, like, oh shit, everything's going to kill me, everything spreads easily, like, it doesn't, you ever worry about that stuff?
Well, you know, not so much. I think, it's funny, I'm infectious disease trained originally as an infectious disease guy, epidemiologist, you'd think that. I actually don't worry, for me personally, I don't worry about that much, but it was true. With my kids, every time my kids got a fever, I was working on meningitis, which is a different disease back at CDC. It's an infection of the brain.
It's a swelling of the meninges, right?
Swelling of meninges and the high fatality rate. Every time my kid got the flu or a fever, I was sure they had meningitis.
Oh, no.
I haven't checked.
That's right. Because they're your kids.
That's right. They're my kids.
You're in a lab.
Right.
You're working with these infectious diseases.
Right.
And you're like, my kid probably somehow got meningitis.
Yeah, that's very bad. Yeah. Bad thing. But no, I don't really.
So when something like Ebola happens, you know, mm-hmm. and it becomes basically the headline that everyone's talking about, and then there's widespread panic. Oh my God, Ebola! You know, realistically, the percentage of a chance that someone in at least in this country mm-hmm. that all of a sudden Ebola would become an epidemic
a huge
is
deal.
Pretty low, yeah. I would imagine, mm-hmm. because of all the protocols that are in place.
Mm-hmm.
Were people right to freak out so much, or was it just like, no, that's really not a huge problem?
Well, I think, you know, the Ebola thing is really unfortunate. Ebola, of course, is, a really bad disease.
Right.
And huge case fatality rate and difficult to care for the patients once they get sick. But it is like a lot of infectious diseases. We do know something about it. And we do know how it spread from previous studies and epidemiologists and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And so I think that the issue was with Ebola, it was not so much that we didn't know what to do. It was more an issue of implementing the control methods in the places where it was happening. Mm-hmm. And those the countries that it erupted in West Africa were unfortunate in that their general healthcare systems were so suboptimal that they couldn't really rise to the occasion in the right way. And I think that the Ebola thing did become a huge issue, not as much because we didn't know the science of it as much as because it was just very difficult to implement the the control mechanisms in the places that it happened.
But do you think people's response to it was did not match what the actual threat level was?
Yeah.
Is there an acceptable or even healthy amount of panic when you're dealing with something like this? You're like, well, yeah, people are more freaked out. They're not going to, you know, they're not going to make stupid decisions. Or is it just not helpful?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that clearly, as I said, Ebola is a bad disease.
Sure.
Anytime it happens, you know, it needs to get ratcheted up to a major level of concern, and key actions have to take place. And I think that not all the time everything happens quickly enough.
Right. What's your biggest challenge with your work? Like, what's the biggest hurdle?
Mm-hmm. With the polio program at this point. You know, I think that, as I said, we've seen a lot of progress in just the last year or two. Getting the political will, getting the partners together, and in each country we're working in polio, it's the way the work gets done is the government of the country is bought into it, and then the local development partners, whether it's WHO or UNICEF or the DFID or USAID, all those folks have to get coordinated to actually get the job done. And in these places where there are multiple problems, like poor routine immunization systems, terrorist attacks, bad logistics, you know, all that kind of stuff. There are a lot of problems to take care of, and I think our major problem right now is a common one to the polio program. It's just getting all of those systems to work together to get a complete immunization of the population at risk, and that takes a lot of coordination, and it takes a lot of determination, especially when you're facing things like civil disturbances and civil wars.
Well, you know, because with polio, obviously everyone came together to create this community of people go, okay, we're actually going to fight it. So I think most people go, oh, why wouldn't you just do that for every, you know, like why specifically polio and why not? Is it just a question of resources and how does it?
Yeah. Well, the decision to eradicate a disease is not a totally easy one. Not all infectious diseases can be eradicated. Polio is a good candidate for that because, as I said, it only infects humans. So that means that all you have to do is vaccinate every kid in the world.
You're not done yet?
And then you're finished. But most infectious diseases are not like that. A lot of infectious diseases have other reservoirs, like tetanus, for example, which is another disease we vaccinate for. It lives in the ground, and it lives in the ground for a really long time. And there's no way you can really get rid of it in the ground.
Yeah.
It's always there. So some diseases are just plain old not eradicable.
Mm-hmm.
And other infections that might be theoretically eradicable, meaning that they don't infect every living thing in the world and you don't have to sterilize the planet to do it. We are still working on the tools to see what, you know, maybe we don't have a vaccine that works well enough to actually get the job done, or we don't have the right, we don't actually have the medicines or vaccines to kill it off. So there's a lot of issues. There are some other potential diseases that could be eradicated, but I think that it's a little bit of a trade-off between how difficult it would be to do that and how much we want to work on other things. One of the things both difficulties in eradicating polio and even the Ebola thing highlight have been that a lot of countries still don't have just the basic system to give most people medical care. And that is a big deal. You know, getting everybody up to a level of health care and nutrition that will address a wide range of problems is really another area of work that the foundation is putting a lot of input into right now, increasing the primary health care system effectiveness and capacity and general health care. The ability to give health care to people in the world is another way to approach a lot of disease issues.
What's your favorite part of your job? What do you like the most? Like, what do you do and go, yes, this is what I want. This is what I want to do.
Well, I mean, you know, the idea of saying, okay, here's an infection and we can actually get rid of it. And we can actually cause a change in the ecology of the world that will get rid of this disease is great. When I see, well, like we've gone now to, you know, haven't had a case in Nigeria, a case of wild poliovirus since July of last year. And that's never been done before. It looks to us like the virus is completely gone from the continent of Africa. To have caused a change like that, to say, okay, we really have an entire huge chunk of the world where this virus is not there. What we've done is use a tool, use a vaccine to actually cause something to happen that is saving kids' lives and making sure that nobody's going to get paralyzed from polio there again. That's a great thing. And the effort that goes through to do that is not really just our effort. We only play a part of it. And when I was in India for 5 years working on the polio program there, part of the program is to do national immunization days to try to identify every kid less than five and make sure they get the vaccine in like a 1 week period. Now in India, every kid under five is 170 million kids spread over the entire country. And so we had teams of vaccinators, and each team was like a mother and a father and then somebody carrying the vaccine thing, going to essentially every house in India, knocking on the door and seeing if there was a kid less than five there. And if there was, they'd put two drops of vaccine in their mouth. That thing, to organize that on a national level to vaccinate 170 million kids is just a huge undertaking.
Well, yeah, someone knocked on my door and said, hey, can I put a droplet in your kid's mouth? I'd be like, leave.
Well, that happens, and that's one of the challenges. But to be able to manage that, to do that in places that are just incredibly difficult, and then to have it work, as in Africa or as in India, is great. If there was a exciting thing that to be a part of, I mean, that's it, really. To see that you've actually contributed to getting rid of a disease.
And how long does it have to be gone for you to say, like, all right, well, we've eradicated it?
Is it
2 years, 5 years, 10 years?
Well, again, the actual plan, and this is based on assessments of how good that surveillance system is that I talked to you about.
Right.
The plan is, after the last case, we want to follow it for 3 years. We want to watch for 3 years, and we don't declare it done until three years after the last case. So
okay,
if we get to the last case in 2015, we won't declare it done until 2018. But during that time, it's not like we haven't done anything. During that time, basically, no kids are getting paralyzed by polio. So it's essentially, we would declare in 2018 that 2015 was the eradication date.
So I'm sure you are a Walking Dead fan. Right?
Yes.
You've seen. You're just like, I'm mad. Can you watch a zombie show? And does, as an epidemiologist, are you like, are you just seeing glaring mistakes that characters are making? Like, don't drink the damn water. Like, you must be. That's where it's spreading. You know, or whatever. Do you watch? Are you able to? Are you ever watch outbreak shows or movies?
Yeah, I do. No. Yeah. I mean, I do. I think. I shouldn't say this, I guess, but zombie shows always particularly bother me a little bit because I have a hard time making that jump from this is what I know in science can happen.
Right.
And then I got those zombies there.
Right.
I just can't make that jump.
That's why it's so terrifying, Dave.
It is terrifying.
Yeah, that's why it's so scary, because they don't know.
I can't think of a body system that could actually work that way.
Okay.
The way zombies do. But
it's comforting that you think that.
Putting that aside, I do think it is interesting to see the outbreak movies, because I think that they do. Sometimes there are glaring errors that are made, and other times it's just oversimplified.
Like 28 Days Later is a great outbreak movie.
Yeah.
So is that, when you watch that, do you go, well, that's never going to happen? Like, it's never, you know, there's not going to be something that's so pandemic that it basically, every government falls and the world is in chaos. Like, it's what science was, we're always a step ahead.
Well, yeah.
Make me feel better, please.
No, that's true. There are two things I would say about that. One is that, you know, it's a bad idea for a virus to kill everything it infects. I mean,
because there's no more hosts.
That's right. Right. Yeah, so that would be a bad thing to do. But I think that, you know, I just look back historically. And if we think, okay, there have been humans on the world for a long time.
Right.
And even in historic time, what has happened? I mean, you know, probably the worst thing that's happened, the worst thing, the Black Plague.
Right.
It was pretty bad.
Yeah, it was not great.
You know, that was a bad thing. And there, you know, you saw a third of Europe die off in a...
God.
In a swath. And that was pretty grim. But even there, you know, there was enough variation, enough genetic variation, both in us and in the and in the bacteria, probably, that you know, it didn't get everybody. I mean, I think that what we have now is, and what you do see in these movies, is we do have the capacity to relatively rapidly, partly because of epidemiologists, but also because of the guys in the lab
sure. Who
are doing stuff, to sort of assess pretty rapidly what's going on and assess how it's being spread. And we certainly are in a much better situation than we were back in the 1300s,
well, I don't,
to address these things.
I don't know what you think you're going to do if a pissed off monkey breaks through a cage and bites you in the face. Then, like, then
that's a bad, that's a bad scene.
That's a very bad scene. just as we're sort of wrapping up, what can people do? Like, is there anything the general public can do to help you do your job, or to help, you know, science in general try to eradicate widespread disease?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think for the polio thing, it's very important. That we finish this job. I mean, it's easy in the United States now. Nobody, you talk to, well, if anybody knows what polio is, you know, you talk to some people, say, oh, isn't that gone? Well, yes, of course, it is gone in the United States, but it's not gone in the world. And I think the most important thing we could look for support with is just the recognition and the affirmation that we can beat this disease, we can eradicate it, but we have to finish the job. Mm-hmm. And continuing to put pressure and support the final efforts to finish it off. Because if we don't finish it off everywhere, it's just going to come back.
Right.
You know, but if we do finish it off in the last places where it is, then we're home free. And then no kid anywhere is going to have to worry about getting paralyzed from poliovirus. And that's what we're really shooting for. But I think that what we can't sort of drop the ball in the last yard, you know, that and in some ways, you know, when you have a disease that's gone from 99% of the world, and then 99% of the world thinks,
well, and that's a problem, because then the media, like people in the media, I'm sure that must play a huge role in, you know, like headline news, because everyone will go, okay, now this is the, for lack of a better term, sexy new disease that everyone's freaked out about, and they forget about the one that they didn't finish before, and it's not getting attention, which means it's not getting as much funding, which means it's not getting as much, you know, the resources and time devoted to it.
Right, yeah, that's the problem, and people will sometimes complain. They say, oh, look, we're still putting all this money into polio, nobody gets it anymore. Yeah, right. But the reason that nobody's getting it is because we're putting...
And we don't want them to start getting it.
And this is our window of opportunity right here. If we can just make that extra push and finish it, then we can turn the money off.
Sure.
You know, but until we finish it, we can't. We have to protect... We still have to protect the world as long as there's some place that's generating poliovirus. So that's the biggest issue.
Last question. Is there a disease in the world? Is there something in the world where you're like, oh, but that's really scary? Like, is there one that really sort of freaks you out? Like, if it's in a lab where you're like, I don't really want to go in that lab. I'll put on two hazmat suits and I'll look at it from behind glass. Is there anything that's really that's truly horrifying? Or do you have a pretty even even emotional approach to every disease?
You know, I mean, there are diseases that are scarier than other diseases and more acutely threatening. I actually think, as you know, in context of what I said before, that we do have the capacity now to evaluate these things and look and assess the risk and actually take steps against most of them that we can sort of see. You can imagine difficult combinations,
sure.
You know, but No, I don't think there's a disease.
Do different diseases have favorites? Do different diseases have different personalities in a way where you go, well, there do seem to be, you know, certain behavior patterns that they express. Now, I'm not saying that they have a consciousness, but I just mean, like, are there certain personality traits where you would go, oh, well, polio tends to like this, and something else tends to like, can you predict their behavior patterns?
Sure, there are. I mean, polio is an enterovirus. It lives in the gut. It loves sewage.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's going to be there. So, you know,
How long does polio survive outside of the body?
That's a good question. It can survive, it depends. Uh-huh. And it depends a little bit on how much sunlight there is, what the temperature is, blah, blah, blah. But it's basically in terms of hours to days to maybe a week or two if you're really in tough shape. That's why we can get rid of it. Because it'll be in the human body for 4 to 6 weeks, maybe 8 weeks, and if it gets excreted, most of it will die within a couple of hours to a day or two. And then it will all be gone in a little bit, unless it gets picked up by another human, you know. But clearly, these viruses do have ways that they act. So I sometimes feel like I've been in enough places with polio to think if I go into a village, I can sort of almost smell it.
I know what you mean.
I can't really smell it, but I can.
But you have an understanding of what the conditions are.
This is a place.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they do. I mean, things act differently, and that's a little bit what epidemiologists do. In my previous life, working at CDC, we worked on a disease called listeriosis, which is a bacteria, but that has its own way of acting. And there's a recent outbreak in caramelized apples. I don't know if you guys heard about that. You know, you may have read about it in the paper. But that's a very different bacteria. It's a weird one because we know it can actually grow in the refrigerator. Unlike most bacteria, you put them in the fridge. That's why you put them in the fridge, because it's too cold, so bacteria don't grow. Listeria can grow in the fridge. It can actually reproduce there. So it's a disease that's often associated with cheeses and cold cuts and that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, that disease has a characteristic way that it acts. Polio has another characteristic way that it acts. And trying to figure out when you see something, when you see a case of disease, identifying what it is key. And then identifying who's got it and why they've got it is the next step in trying to control it.
This is a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking to you, and I hope that you do. I hope that you're able to eradicate polio, and then cut to you next to David Caruso in like a CSI style opening where polio's gone.
Yeah, sure. That's great. Yeah.
But thanks, Jay. It was really great talking to you, man. Thank you.
For so long.
I know polio
is
so fun. I mean,
you came in 4 times and we're sorry.
I know polio. It turns out it's very intense, polio.
Yeah, polio's intense.
Julie, thank you.
I've had some fun on polio.
You've had. What do you. So, just could you please tell people specifically what it is? I mean, I have your bio here,
sure.
So I see that you are the director of program related investments for the Gates Foundation.
Yes.
But what does that mean?
What does that mean?
What is that?
What is that?
What are those words?
Those words mean, so most of what the foundation does is grant making. We do about $4 billion of grant making per year, but we have this secret pool that actually can do...
Wait, don't tell anyone then.
No, sorry. They can do equity investing in companies. We can do loans. We can do guarantees. And so I manage the pool. It's a $1.5 billion investment pool that actually invests in companies, in... investment funds, in partnerships to advance our program goals in partnership with essentially private sector companies.
Right. And ultimately, what are your program goals?
Our program goals are eradicating polio or
right.
eradicating malaria or increasing digital payment infrastructure around the world. So in places where we think that a partnership with a private company can advance those goals, then we'll go in and structure something really cool to create incentives for companies to focus on these problems.
So you're not necessarily doing it to generate more money, you're doing it to complete the goals.
Correct. So if you think about it, if we're trying to solve all these incredibly difficult problems, we need to get cool companies, we need to get entrepreneurs, we need to get innovation, we need all the skills that the private sector brings to bear.
So you're not going to throw a ton of money at Snapchat.
No, sorry.
unless
you can eradicate polio.
Unless you can eradicate polio. Vaccinate.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Hey, there's polio over here. Don't come over here. Cool. Good to know.
Oh, wait. It just disappeared. The address is on there. I don't know. It was Snapchat.
Well, you must have to make tough decisions then, based on, because obviously there are an infinite number of causes in the world which require resources, and so how do you pick and choose? Like, how do you prioritize, basically?
Well, you just spent a while with Jay Winger, who's a brilliant man who knows more about polio. I don't know anything about polio, so the way that
it's
we
bad
do
news.
It, it's bad news.
Don't get it.
So we don't. So I don't. I manage an investment pool, but my investment pool is always deployed in partnership with our program team. So I've got some of the most brilliant people around the world. I often joke that I play a biotech investor on TV. I don't know anything about biotech, but I actually have a pretty big pool of biotech investments. How can I possibly do that? I'm smart enough to know that I don't actually know anything about antibodies, vaccines. I don't know this stuff. These are words. But so what I do is I partner with these brilliant scientists and these brilliant policymakers who actually understand how we're going to solve these problems. And then we then partner with the companies to try to figure out how to use the resources that they bring to bear.
So you're basically you're smart enough to look at people and go, you're smart too.
Uh-huh.
You fix that thing. And here's some resources to go do that.
Yeah. One of the funny experiences when I first started this was I was sitting in a room with Chris Wilson, who's the head of our discovery. Brilliant man. And he was talking, and I realized that I didn't understand maybe half the words that are coming out of his mouth. But the really comforting thing is he only understands half the words that are coming out of my mouth. But we sort of know each other. We know that he's brilliant on scientific things. I may not be brilliant on finance things, but he thinks I am. So it all kind of works.
And so what are your biggest challenges right now? Like, because it... I think the way most people think about money is wrong, in the sense that they go, well, you just throw money at it, and it somehow it's a genie, then just magically it solves itself. But
we call that magical finance.
Magical finance, but money needs, it needs an infrastructure, and it needs someone figuring out how to distribute it evenly and distribute it properly, and so what are the challenges with that?
It's actually really hard. So it sounds really exciting. Everybody, oh, you have such a cool job. It's actually really hard for that reason, meaning money's not the problem. The problem is how do we create... I mean, we're very simple creatures. We respond to incentives. And the private sector is designed to respond to some pretty simple incentives. Profit for investors, profitability for companies. You know, capitalism works because it's a pretty simple incentive system. What we're doing is we're introducing a different kind of incentive. We're basically saying we want to use all the good things that you have around manufacturing capability and innovation, and we want to apply it to something that's not driven by that sort of simple profit incentive. So I think that my job, and I think it's a skill that we've developed, I don't think we're, we've finished developing that skill. It's really how do I create the right incentives with these companies to focus on these problems? And we can use a bunch of different things. We can use money. We can throw money at the problem. We can use, partnership, meaning we're bringing skills and knowledge about these markets that they may not have. You know, the foundation has an incredible network of people and knowledge that we can also bring to bear. So what we're really looking for is those partnerships where it's good for the company, they can build a business off of it, and it's good for us in that their skills and their capabilities are being brought to bear in a really constructive way, not forcing them to do it or not having to throw money at them, but in a way where those incentives are aligned to get things done.
And how do you do that? I mean, how do you make people understand, this is the most effective way to filter this money through the system in order to achieve the goal?
Yeah. So we use everybody in the development world, they call this innovative finance. And what I say is, it's actually not that innovative. It's really simple financial tools applied to areas that that haven't had these financial tools. So let me give you an example. We use a really simple tool in the health commodity market. So vaccines are really important to us. Contraceptive commodities are really important to us. And you've got great manufacturers out there producing these things, but what they don't have is certainty about the markets. They don't understand the donor environment. They don't understand what's going on in Africa. And so what we do is we come in and we say, listen, we know what's going on. So in the contraceptive implant space, Melinda, made a big announcement. So we know there's a lot of money for family planning out there. We're going to guarantee you a volume. We're going to do a volume contract. And in exchange for that, in exchange for bringing something that you need, certainty about the market, we're going to ask you to lower your prices. And so it's a win-win. They get guaranteed volume, they get a bigger business, and we get lower prices, which means we can use the same donor dollars to double the number of people that can get access to these vaccines or these contraceptive implants.
How is it different than working in the private sector or working like a for-profit when you're trying to, you know, when you're working in a pool, a fund pool? What are some of the major differences? Or what did you learn when you came over?
Yeah, absolutely. It was actually, I come from an emerging market private equity background. So I ran around the world making investments in companies. And I sort of thought I was going to do something really similar there. You know, look at management teams, think about business models, you know, think about what are the great businesses. It was kind of a re-education for me because I'm still doing that same thing. We still need to find the best entrepreneurs and the best investors. We need to do all the, hold ourselves accountable to that sort of the rigorous processes that investment funds go through. At the same time, I got to shift my mindset. I have to think about how do I use investment tools to solve problems. And that was actually a surprisingly difficult shift to make, because when you're in an investment mindset, you're sort of programmed. You're a mouse on a wheel, you're a hamster on a wheel. You just go and you do the same thing. And you're programmed for the pattern recognition of great management teams, great business models. If you have to then shift and say, that's important, but it's not the core thing. The core thing is, how do I use businesses to eradicate malaria? How do I engage with businesses to get as many contraceptives to poor women in these countries as I can? And it shifts your mindset.
Wow. And do you feel, when you were in the private sector before, mm-hmm. what were some of the common mistakes that you would see? Like when you're analyzing a business structure, mm-hmm. what do you see at the outset where you go, oh, they don't know what they're doing because of this and this? And it's like, what are some of the reasons that businesses fail?
I mean, in my old world, you know, business, especially in the emerging markets, you know, it's a lot people. It's management teams. It's, you know, can people get things done? So management talent is a key component, and it's something that we have to figure out how to bring over to our... And that's one of the reasons why we think this is such a powerful tool. So if we can get those great entrepreneurs that are focused on Snapchat, which I'm sure Snapchat is wonderful.
I mean, I've heard about it. I don't, you know.
I don't know about it. So, I mean, there's so much creativity. I mean, there's so many great people going in, creating businesses, creating solutions that we can't even imagine. I think one of the things that's so exciting for us is how do we get that, you know, incredible talent to focus on our issues.
Humanity rather than just...
Yeah,
like,
and honestly, I think people do. I think people want to. I mean, I don't... of course they want to get filthy rich, but I also think they want to benefit humanity. And that's the excitement about this. Again, it's hard. You have to create the right incentives. You have to...
Well, I think people don't ever think about what's the stage beyond filthy rich. Like, okay, you have $100 million. Now what? You know, like, yeah. Now what do you do with it? There's one thing that I never understand is what do people... You know, if someone has... $100 million. Well, it's not like they just have $100 million in a bank. What do you do with that money? Like, how do you manage that? You're basically putting it in a lot of different things to diversify, I would imagine, to keep it safe. Or I don't even know how you approach the fund that size is that big.
Oh, well, my $100 million that right. I manage.
Yeah.
You know, where
do you keep your hundy? It's in your boots. Yeah, it's in your boots. What did you learn from your, like, looking at successful businesses, looking at failing businesses? What sort of tools did you pick up before you came into this job that helped?
You know, the thing about investments and the great investors, and I don't count myself in one of those, the great investors have instinctive pattern recognition. So it's that smell of what's going to work and what's going to not work. And that's probably the most important characteristic that I learned. You know, you can make all the right plans, but a coup in Côte d'Ivoire is going to completely undermine, you know, the investment that you made in a great company. It's sort of, so you got to have the smell for those types of things. You have to be able to be comfortable in working in ambiguous, sort of chaotic realities, which is what, you know, business environments are organic places. You know, great entrepreneurs, great ideas emerge where you don't expect them to do. So it's really, how do you find that pattern recognition to find the great people with the great ideas and really enable those people to do things? And we're trying to do something really similar here, but on some levels, a much grander scale. But if we can't get those sort of outliers, those great ideas, take risks on things that are really going to enable fundamental transformation in the markets in which we work, it's going to be tough. The one thing I will say, one of my other learnings for emerging markets specifically that I don't think we necessarily get working in the US or Europe is that it is incredibly difficult to grow businesses, to be an entrepreneur. those business environments are so tough. And so I have a huge amount of respect for entrepreneurs and businesses in these markets. But I also know that without sort of fundamental transformation in the economics of how those markets work, it's really tough to have the kind of scale transformation that we're looking for. So, you know, one of the sectors that's super exciting to me right now is digital infrastructure, because what digital infrastructure does is it leapfrogs over physical infrastructure. So all the work that we're doing on mobile payments has the ability to do a, really a fundamental transformation in reaching poor people. So, you know, if you think about banking, if you think about even building businesses that are focused on poor people, it's hard. You can't, you know, it's hard to reach them. It's, you know, to have a poor customer walk into a bank is really expensive for a bank, so they're not going to serve it without a fundamental change in the economics.
Sure.
Digital infrastructure allows us to change those economics.
Right, because then you don't have to build a physical place and have people, you know, you can do it from here.
Right. And that's such an exciting potential transformation. So that's my learning is, one, being an entrepreneur is bloody hard. You need to have the pattern recognition to understand where you can put a great entrepreneur with a company. But in these markets especially, sort of changing the economics of the underlying businesses, whether it's in ag value chains, whether it's in digital infrastructure and financial services, whether it's in healthcare delivery, that's going to really be the thing that changes the way our ability to reach millions and millions of people at scale.
Well, in terms of, you know, this sort of social entrepreneurship, and then also in the private sector as well, I guess people really do have to understand not only what a good idea is, and then on top of that, are the people around it competent enough to execute it? But then outside of that, is it something that people are, what's the adoption rate? Because you cannot predict what people, I mean, you can kind of go, well, people tend to like, or this is something that people might need, but you can't control. I mean, like, there's so many things that, you know, it's not just whatever the sort of cultural zeitgeist is, but also, you know, are they ready for it? You know, like, maybe they're not, maybe it's a couple years too early. So how do you game that system?
You know, I think you have to have a really big appetite for failure, which Bill does, which is one of the wonders of working with him. Because you're absolutely right. It's so messy. There's so many different factors. And so you got to be willing to go out and, you know, accept the fact that a lot of these things aren't going to work and take bets. And that's one of the things that's built into our investment program. You know, we're very, very conscious of the risks that we're taking. We actually, you know, our core analytics is not around how much returns it's going to be. It's how much risk are we taking, and are we willing to take that risk in a way that's really clear-sighted? And we're totally honest. We're totally transparent with Bill about the risk we're taking, because I don't want him to come back and say, you promised me. I want him to understand that, hey, there's like a 75% likelihood that we're going to have to write off this investment, but it's worth doing. And it's worth doing because if it wins, if it's successful, it has such a great impact on the population.
Well, there's a human currency. There's a human currency, not just you know, how many fat stacks can I get back from this? Like, you're basically trying to literally improve humanity.
Yeah. And when it works, it's pretty amazing. So we've got one investment that we've been working on for 3 years as a foundation. We just did a second round earlier this year. That's a digital payments company in Bangladesh. And getting back to your comment about human, you know, the entrepreneur that runs this is unbelievable, Kamal Qadir. And it's the Qadir brothers in Bangladesh who are kind of famous. Iqbal Qadir, his older brother, founded and grew Grameen Phone, which is one of the first and biggest mobile deployments 20 years ago in the developing world. So these serial entrepreneur brothers are out there, and they figured out how to create a mobile money deployment that worked. And so we invested $6 million in grant money about 3 years ago, and another $15 million last year. And they've gone in 24 months from zero to 15 million customers. And it gets back to, like, when we looked at, if you looked at like the analysis we did, we're like, oh my God, this, you know, this is early stage. It's an unproven model, you know, never been done before outside of Kenya. Like, this is crazy. There's so many political issues associated with it. It's like, oh my, you know, this is terrifying to put this much money in, but it worked. And it worked because Kamal and Iqbal are brilliant, but customers want it. It's a customer use case. It makes sense for them. Transferring money over their cell phones, their cheap $7 cell phones that you can buy in, you know, a bazaar in Bangladesh via a text message. You can transfer money, you know, from Dhaka out into the rural areas back to their families, and it's under a penny in order to do that, versus they would have to pay to physically transfer that. And
oh, right.
They love it. The you know, people are just taking, we don't even know how people are using this. And it's one of those things where it all works. Now, I can tell you, I don't want to tell you about all the cases where it hasn't. That would make it look bad. But it's really beautiful when it does work.
Sorry to jump in here, but Bcash has become like a cultural thing now too. You Bcash money.
You Bcash money. And it's
that's the name of the company.
Yeah, it's the name of the company. Sorry, I should have said.
So they've actually become. So it's become like what is that? Metonymy or so, where the word becomes the thing, like the brand name becomes like Kleenex.
Yeah, exactly.
Now it's Bcash.
You fly into Bcash, and they have this beautiful magenta origami bird, and it's all over the city. And literally, people will, I'll Bcash you that.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
So if you're not Bcash. It's a tough but that's an interesting, I mean, wow, just finding the opportunity for the right time, like, oh, people were just ready for this now, like the technology was available, emotionally they were ready for it, you know, it was just, I mean, these types of, you know, I think we've become so spoiled in our country in terms of innovation, we're like brats about innovation because, you know, because of what's happened in the last, you know, 30, 40 years in terms of, you know, personal computing. You know, if something doesn't get completely innovated in 18 months or a year, like, oh, what's happening? It's like, yeah, 5 years ago, you're already this much better off. You know, like, why are we screwed because we're so spoiled? I mean,
in some ways, actually, to be totally honest with you, think America. I mean, I spent a lot of time working in development. I lived in Africa for a few years, and we're spoiled. We're spoiled by innovation. You could say that negatively, but I think you also can say, hey, we live in an incredible time. And if we can take that innovation capability and, you know, the good hearts of entrepreneurs, of innovators, you know, you go to Stanford and Stanford Business School, we do some recruiting at Stanford Business School. And, you know, I remember when I was in business school 20 years ago, nobody had any interest in social sectors. You know, it's all consulting and investment banking. Now you go into business schools, you go to Stanford Business School, and half the class, they can't even fill the consulting slots because half the class is like, we want to go out and want to change the world. Oh. And I think that's a great thing. So I'm an optimist. Yeah, you can say Americans are spoiled, which we are. But I also think that, you know, especially younger generations really care about making the world a better place. And I actually think that that's going to be the major factor, both in terms here, but also diaspora, like diaspora returnees into these markets. If you go into Nairobi right now, you've got some brilliant people coming back, thinking about how they take their skills that they, you know, that they built up working, you know, in the developed world to the countries, and they're going to be an incredible force for innovation and change.
And it's not even, I mean, I don't mean to come down on America about it, because I just think it's sort of I think it's kind of a human. I asked Bill about it too, is that, you know, is convenience a bad thing? Mm-hmm. Because we're so addicted to convenience and innovation, and it's like, oh, we just need more, and we're already, you know, you get one device and the next day you're already looking at all the blogs like, what's the next iteration of the device going to be? Like, why don't you just enjoy the one that you have that does a million things that you couldn't do 2 years ago? You know, is convenience a problem, or how do we temper that? Like, is it perspective? I mean, you have perspective because you've lived in Africa, you've been around the world, you've seen outside the country, and you kind of understand, and you may be a little immune to it. So
how do Americans get less spoiled?
Yeah.
That's a good question. When you can figure out it, I'll try to put it onto my kids. I don't know. Again, I'm a little bit like Bill. I'm kind of optimistic. And I believe, you know, first of all, one of the things that's really cool and really important is the degree to which innovation allows. So we have all this innovation happening and we get distracted by it, right? So, but when you have really great innovation that then leapfrogs in these markets, it's hugely beneficial. So let me just give you, I worked in Nigeria in 1998 when pre-cell phone. I was working for an investment fund and there were 300,000 landlines in Nigeria. So you go in, you fly into Nigeria, and nobody could communicate. In order to communicate, you had to go to a hotel. It cost an unbelievable amount of money. It was just insane. And 5 years later, because of cell phone technology, which is, you know, American-based innovation. You've got companies and they're printing money because the uptake, again, is not dissimilar from what we're seeing with Bcash. And you go in and Nigerians are some of the most entrepreneurial people. I mean, talk about attention deficit. Like, they're the most entrepreneurial. You know, you give them anything to work with and they've got, like, the worst government system in the world. And within that, they manage to get things done because they're just these incredible entrepreneurial people. And you go in and all my Nigerian friends have 3 cell phones and they're running 5 businesses because of cell phones. So, and I've said I want to at some point when I'm don't have as many things to do, go out and prove this, which is that the cell phone has had such an incredible impact on people's lives, their ability to generate income, their ability to form businesses, their ability to take care of their families. I think it's had more impact than 20 years of World Bank lending. So that's what we're looking for. So if Americans want to be bratty and entitled but are going to innovate, I don't really care. I want them to take that. What I want to do is I want to have a great African entrepreneur take that bratty innovation and apply it and make the world, make it lives better for so many poor people.
Were you able to help out that Nigerian prince keep his $800 million?
Yeah, that's why I have $100 million. You didn't make that investment?
No, I just didn't.
Dude.
Yeah, I know. I got lazy. I was going to, and then Game of Thrones was on, and I just...
And the boots.
I got busy, and that's...
That's what afforded
that was boots. The secret.
There's a real guy.
No, there's a couple Nigerian princes who just really need your help getting the money out.
No one will respond to me. What do you think is the most important innovation of the last 20 years?
I mean, again, I'm biased because I saw it and I invested in it. It's
cell phone. Yeah. But
I mean, you could say internet, but obviously people would information based communication.
Yeah.
A lot of episodes of Seinfeld would have been much shorter if they were cell phones.
Or if someone said, I think you misunderstand what I meant.
You know, there's an anecdote that I spent way too much time in hotels in cities in Africa, and I was having a drink with the Diageo rep at one point, and he talked about the fact, because Diageo owns... breweries are a very successful business all over Africa. And he said that when cell phones came in, their revenues went down because people made the choice. People trade off between drinking and talking to their friends.
Really? Well, I guess in a way, drinking is a form of, like, they're socializing. A lot of people are socializing. So if they can
talk to your friends without having some drinks.
Yeah. I don't know.
If you're really poor, you actually have to trade it off. Do you talk to your friends?
You actually have to...
Proud to be an American.
Get to know.
My point being that cell phones were really transformative in these markets. They've been incredible. And that's why the digital infrastructure stuff is so interesting, because we're taking it to another level. And if you think about the businesses that can be enabled by being able to transfer money over a cellular infrastructure, it's incredible if you start thinking. And you start thinking about information systems. So if you start thinking about health data and what we could do with health data, if you start thinking about consumer data and what we could do with consumer data in these markets. Like, I don't know. I don't know where this is going to go, but I know that what it's done is it's dramatically lowered the transaction costs to working with the poor, and that's one of the biggest inhibitions for companies to be successful.
Well, it's what I think the point when I was earlier sort of saying, like, oh, we're addicted to innovation, but, you know, in a country like India, so now Bcash, now they've done it. Like, it's difficult to then, like, well, what's their next innovation going to be? Because now everyone has a phone, and now everyone has, you know, the ability to trade cash digitally. So, you know, like, looking ahead, what do you think some of the next innovations are? What are some hurdles that we have to overcome?
Yeah, I'll give you an example of that, because I think it's actually a really interesting question. So we're not invested in this company. I think Bill is, as an individual, because we don't do international education. But there's this really great great company, Bridge International, that does essentially franchise education. It's like education in a box. And a lot of people have invested in them. They have an incredibly low cost model for education, and it's been enabled. And they started in Kenya, and it would be, I don't know that they could do their business if they couldn't collect school fees over the cell phone. So the point being that you're going to see businesses built on top of the cell infrastructure, because you can't do a low cost school model. It's really difficult if you have to go out and walk and collect fees.
Sure.
Whereas if you can transfer it and there's an expected transfer, or actually we're invested in a company called MCOPA, which is doing solar lanterns. And the way that their business model works to reach the poor is they've got a chip that turns off the solar lantern if the customer doesn't pay for the solar lantern.
Okay.
So, you know, it's an electricity company. And the customers pay 40 shillings a month for their electricity. And it's an alternative to sort of kerosene, which costs more money than the 40 cents a shilling for this solar lantern. And the beauty of it, so it's a solar lantern, it's an electricity company, but you couldn't do it. You couldn't make it work if you didn't have the chip in there that allows you to finance it and allows them to pay on a regular, and the payments over the cell phone. So this is just the beginning and of a wave of things that we don't even know are going to sit on top of this infrastructure.
Is there anything brewing that's essentially like an industrial-sized 3D printer where you can send a machine into an area and very quickly and expensively, you know, create housing?
Oh, yeah. Haven't you seen them?
Well, I've seen prototypes for like, oh, look, if we're going to create like a lunar colony or like build something on Mars, one of the things that they would need to do is